You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, October 23rd, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening.
Did I scare you?
Evan, this is not the closest show to Halloween. Well, next week's show will be recorded on the 30th.
I get that.
Released after Halloween.
But
so this is the last show released before Halloween, so I guess
that's
okay. Thank
you. Yes. Thank you.
So did you guys hear about this scariest haunted house in the world?
Oh, my gosh.
I do not classify that as a haunted house.
Well, what is it? Wait. You're assuming that lots of people know what you're talking about. What are you talking about?
All right. So the headline reads, "The World's Scariest Haunted House." And they're offering, how about this, Bob? They offer a $20,000 prize to anyone who can make it through the entire experience. This takes place in Tennessee. It's called McCamey Manor, McKamey Manor. And it is being dubbed the world's scariest haunted house. Before you could even think about going into this, you have to meet certain requirements. 21 years or older. You have to complete a sports physical. You have to pass a drug test. You have to provide proof of medical insurance. You have to be screened via phone. You have to be recorded through the entire process of going through it. Plus, you signed a 40-page waiver. And then you have to watch a 2-hour video, which effectively prepares you for the experience, in which you're going to see footage of past visitors who have all of them have quit the experience before the end. Now, that sounds impressive in a certain way. However, when you realize the whole experience is a 10-hour experience, I mean, to get from start to finish, you know, that alone is a barrier, no matter what the
heck
it is.
That's a marathon, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, but then you go through this basically physical and I don't know, psychological bombardment of sensations, being manhandled, being blindfolded, sensory deprivation, among so many things that are going on.
Right.
You're being scared out of your wits the entire time.
Right. And like I said, this isn't a haunted house. Clearly not a haunted house. It's, you know, it's, to me, this is a psychological torture house. And it's, I mean, it's not, it's like a specialty thing that their job is to psychologically break you before you reach the end, so they don't have to pay you 20 grand. And who, you know, what's the appeal? I don't understand. You know, what are you trying to find your psychological limits on, you know, who, I don't know why anyone would be interested in that. It's a completely different beast. It's for, I don't know who would be into such an experience, but certainly not me. And no, you know, no haunters that I'm familiar with or would be into anything like this. But it's, hey, I mean, if you want to go through that and people are offering it, then, you know, go for it. But not a haunted house in my book.
I saw footage of a woman being trapped inside of a coffin, and she had a huge anxiety attack while she was in there. And by the time they let her out, she was like stumbling. And there's a safe word. You have to have a safe word to stop the experience and basically get off the ride. And afterwards, right, she was like mesmerized, like kind of stumbling around the halls with that 1,000-yard stare in her eyes. And she wasn't really aware of that she was out of it or in it. So it was brutal.
Yeah, it's nuts. I mean, if you want a real haunted house, I suggest going to foresterfear.org. And that's my haunted house with my partners in Danbury, Connecticut. The last day is Saturday, October 26th. So that's the day this podcast is being uploaded. So if you're listening to this early and you're in the area, hey, come down. Go to foresterfear.org and find the address. And it's cheap and fun. We really killed it. It's such a great, great fun experience. No psychological torture involved.
And no 40-page waivers either, right, Bob?
No, but we are not responsible for any therapy that may be required in the near future.
This is not a guarantee. Well, although the owner claims it's not torture, he says that's wrong. That there'll be close encounters with monsters you may be touched.
What does it cost?
Extreme sensory.
How much?
A bag of dog food. Bag of dog food.
You have to bring a bag of dog food?
$25 or something like
that. No, it's a bag of dog food.
Oh, it's an actual bag of dog food.
Huh. He owns 5 dogs, apparently, so he just wants to be paid in dog food.
Dog food.
What the owner isn't telling you is that he's also receiving payment from people who want to come in and scream and throw things at other people.
Do any of you guys think you could get through it if you had to?
No.
No.
Why?
What would break you?
I don't think
What
I
would
could.
Break you?
The sensory deprivation part, I think, would do things to me that I can't predict. And
it's hard to say, Steve. I mean, I'm not prone to claustrophobia or anxiety or anything like that. And, you know, I mean, I've jumped out of planes and done some scuba diving, done some crazy stuff. So I don't know. I think there'd probably be something that I'm like, you know, I'm just so done with this. You know, I don't like being manhandled because they can touch you. They can touch you.
I don't know. I saw some footage of them like pouring something into someone's mouth. It looked like gummy worms or something, you know, and like,
That's the kind of stuff that, I mean, disgusting stuff. Yeah. I mean, what's the point? What are you trying to prove? I don't know the details of all the crazy stuff that they do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure I would bail at some point.
Yeah, I would
if
not.
If you're going to make me like make eat it. Worms or put weird stuff in my mouth, I mean, no.
In a traditional haunted house, you have, you know, it's like a wave sign. You know, you have like a moment of fright or scare, and then you have a moment of relief, and you know, you can reflect on that and laugh, and you know, and it's mostly like jump
most
out.
People, Jay. But if you saw some of the kids in my haunted house, they were terrorized. They were like really freaked out. So this is inevitable. You run a haunted house, you're going to run into people who are so freaked out that you have to take them out through the chicken exit. They cannot finish the haunt.
The chicken exit.
One weekend we had like seven or eight people pee in their pants. We had two people pee in their pants this past weekend that I heard of. We had 1,000 people. Everybody loved it. Rave reviews. But there's always going to be a handful of people that are so freaked out they can't handle it.
Yeah, I agree with you guys though. I think that like putting stuff in your mouth or whatever is cheating. If you can scare somebody into bailing with just, I think what's fair game is like things that are just super creepy.
Right. You know?
And I think sensory deprivation is fair game. I think claustrophobia is fair game. You can't force people to eat or drink something. That, right, I think, is cheating. Yeah, I agree.
Right. How about this one, guys? How about this one? How about screaming in your face for extended periods of time?
Oh, gosh.
I don't know. I have toddlers, so I know what that's like.
Oh, I'm going to go to your thing this weekend, Bob, so maybe on next week I'll give a review.
Okay, sweet.
About,
all right.
Your,
love
your
it. Great
forest.
Idea.
All right, guys, tell me what you think about this. This mm-hmm. is a open letter written by a number of celebrities to journalists. They write, "Dear journalists who have called us hypocrites, you're right. We live high-carbon lives, and the industries that we are part of have huge carbon footprints. Like you and everyone else, we are stuck in this fossil fuel economy, and without systemic change, our lifestyles will keep us causing climate and ecological harm."
Oh my gosh, Steve, it's so interesting that you bring this up because honestly, hopefully I don't take too long to do this, so I'm sorry to interject, but I have to tell you about a conversation that I recently actually had with a friend that I feel like is sort of just along this vein. So I have historically done some work with specifically like one fossil fuel company, and it was not promoting fossil fuels. It was not promoting oil or natural gas or quote unquote clean coal or anything that I like, you know, fundamentally do have moral objections to. It actually had to do with some like STEM programs that they were doing for kids where they were taking a certain amount of money and putting it into these STEM educational initiatives. That said, I have a friend who basically, I have another friend who wanted to get some insight about whether or not a bunch of us SciComers had worked with fossil fuel industries. And one of the people on the thread was like adamantly against it, said that there was kind of a group of YouTubers that want to boycott working with fossil fuel companies. And, you know, sort of was very strict and clear about the fact that he felt like this was greenwashing doing these STEM initiatives or maybe alternative initiatives and that we shouldn't be supporting them. And, you know, he even made some very kind of, I think personally, black and white thinking comment, like maybe even committing a logical fallacy there to say that, like, they say that they're promoting STEM, but all of their actions are actually like anti-science.
Yeah, that's complicated. So if a company that maybe does some hinky things is doing something genuinely good for PR, okay, but they're still doing something genuinely good.
Because of course we do know that fossil fuels heavily contribute to climate change. Like, nobody's denying that, and nobody's saying that fossil fuel companies are not culpable. So please understand that when I make these kind of arguments, I'm not saying yay fossil fuel, but what I am saying is that it's a lot more complicated than that, because the truth of the matter is we all use fossil fuel. So I think this argument, like, are we hypocrites because we use fossil fuel? Well, until the system changes, you can't call us hypocrites or whatever. Maybe we are hypocrites, but we're just doing what we can. It's a lot more complicated than that.
But to be clear, we're not exonerating them either. They are absolutely culpable. Yeah, they have they are running a denialist campaign, which is bad, what they're doing. No question.
And, well, but the government is also, governments are also enabling it because of how much money is tied in there.
Yeah. And the voters, because it's a huge block of voters who are supporting the politicians who are supporting the fossil fuel industry. It's an ecosystem.
Right.
But the other angle here is, what's our personal responsibility in when you're stuck in a system that confines your choices, right? And this comes up with more than just climate change. This comes up with other things as well, you know, not only our carbon footprint, but like eating meat, for example, or whatever. So you say
it's tied into
recycling,
that,
right? You know, resource management and land use and, you know, anything like that. Or just, you know, income inequality. Should, you know, everyone give away their money to people who are poorer than you until everyone has the same amount of money in the world? Do you not care as much about a child in a, you know, poor developing nation as you do about children in your neighborhood or your own kids? You can make a moral argument for, unless you're doing everything, you're culpable and you're not doing enough and you're part of the system. So where's a reasonable balance, right? Where is there a reasonable balance of, yes, we do need to recognize that the system is the problem, but we are part of that system and we have to be, it doesn't absolve us either. But I get the feeling like the celebrities in this letter are taking the maximal, it's not our fault. Like, yes, we have massive carbon footprints, but we're stuck in this system. And what could we do? You know,
they're shrugging their shoulders in a way.
But I think that this was a clumsy way to make it, because it's so easy to also say, like, yeah, but you're entitled celebrities who are defending your privilege, and you're couching it in this, well, we need systemic change. Of course we need systemic change. And it's absolutely true that no individual choices you're going to make are going to affect climate change. We need vast systemic change. Because again, when I wrote about this, I don't know if you guys you guys watch The Good Place?
Mm-hmm. Of course. Awesome.
Okay, so mild spoiler here. At one point, they realize that no one's getting into The Good Place. All right, this is a big spoiler. Because, because you can't, nobody could make a good decision. Because everything you do has negative unintended consequences.
It's almost like a butterfly effect.
Yeah, like you buy a piece of fruit in the supermarket and you trace that all the way back to its origin, and it involved some, you know, hanky-panky somewhere along the line. Someone was exploited or some harm was being done.
Right.
Yeah, and so if you count all of the unintended consequences of everything that you do, everyone's living in a net negative karma, you know. How could you, you know, do what you do, live your life? Like, we're going to Australia and New Zealand to go to conferences. Should we not do that? We talked about this recently. Like, what do we do? I mean, do we just not go anywhere anymore because we want to minimize our carbon footprint?
Some people say yes to that.
But do we want to shut down our civilization? And so then you're feeding the politics of the denialist side if you do that.
Right.
So they want to destroy civilization. All right. So there's another angle here, which is fascinating, because you have this conflict between, you know, let's say systemic, political, corporate responsibility and individual responsibility. And here's the thing. Historically, corporations have used campaigns promoting individual responsibility as a way to absolve themselves of corporate responsibility.
They push it on us, huh?
Yeah. So, for example, and this is the one that blew my mind, is you guys remember the crying American Indian and the Keep America Beautiful campaign.
1970s, right?
This was like an iconic image of a Native American walking, you know, around a city and seeing all the trash, and then some guy like throws a garbage bag out their car window and he cries, right? And it was by the Keep America Beautiful campaign. And also, what's interesting, this is irrelevant, but the actor is actually Italian. He's not even Native American. the tagline was that people start litter, only people can solve litter, right? So they're saying like this is 100% an individual problem. And they created the phrase litter bug to stigmatize individuals who litter. It was basically by the bottling industry because they moved from recyclable glass bottles to disposable plastic bottles. And this created a glut of trash. And in order to deflect attention from the decision they made at the corporate level, which produced this massive increase in trash, they started this campaign to convince the public that this was an individual issue, that it's a litter bug's fault. If there's trash around, it's because some litter bug threw that trash out there. And it worked. The campaign absolutely worked. So that wasn't a sincere campaign. It was one that had a hidden agenda.
Yeah, I mean, what you know, Steve's main point, which is seems obvious, but it's just the truth. We are dependent on fossil fuels right now. There's really not much you can do. If you have to drive to work, if you have a 20-minute commute, what are your options? You know, you could try to carpool.
So there's responsibility at every level, right? There's different hierarchical levels of responsibility. We have collective responsibility as government, corporations, and also as individuals. But we also have just recognized the practicality of it, and both and what can individuals do and what effect individuals can have, which I think in something like climate change is extremely limited. And there's evidence to support this. Like, sure, you know, switch out your bulbs for LED. Absolutely. There's no reason not to do that. I think that if people should do the things that are good for them, that are also good for the environment and good, you know, for society. And that's just a matter of being aware, being educated. You know, like you save money.
Inflate your tires.
You say, inflate your tires. I wrote that in my article. Most people don't realize, like, probably one of the biggest impacts you could have on your carbon footprint is to keep your tires well inflated. Right. But you don't see PSAs about that very often. But the things that people do focus on, like, I'm going to buy local and organic, are actually harmful. They're harmful for the environment. So there's just a ton of misinformation out there. So take the time to be reasonably well informed so that when there are win-wins, like you could save money. Being efficient actually saves you money and lowers your carbon footprint. That's a win-win. Why not do that? That's just laziness. Not doing it is either you're misinformed or you're lazy. And so that I think people should take personal responsibility for, but not for the fossil fuel infrastructure that our civilization is currently dependent upon. That's the kind of systemic change that we have to do through politics. There's a lot of nuance and a lot of things you gotta balance, which is often the case on topics that we talk about.
But one other point that I think is kind of important to make is that I feel really bad that I think as a culture, we do tend to demonize the scientists that work in these industries. There are a lot of really hardworking scientists and engineers who are just as legitimate of scientists as scientists and engineers who work at NASA or who work at any other type of industry, but we vilify them because they work for, you know, Shell or BP or ExxonMobil or whatever. And I think that's kind of a bummer. It's like because a handful of corporate executives are making X number of times the wages of their lowest paid workers and are doing deals in Congress that are shady AF, we're somehow vilifying like hardworking scientists who are actually, I think, doing really good and important work. And plus, we rely on them. And we can't forget that. It's just not that easy. It's not that simple. It's a lot more nuanced than that.
Right. I think if you're taking a black and white, good and evil approach, you probably are a hypocrite. Because there's, I'm sure if somebody examined your life, again, as I say, unless you're living off the grid, I'm sure there are things that you do that raise your carbon footprint that you could be doing better, you know. But the other thing is, like, how much are people going to have to turn their lives upside down for every little ounce of apparent advantage? There's a diminishing return you get to. But honestly, I do think that probably the best thing any individual can do is to be well informed enough to make an effective vote. Right? If you did that, if you had made an informed vote, that's probably the biggest impact you could have on your carbon footprint, to be honest with you. Okay, let's move on. Kara, you're going to tell us about the first news item, prime editing. What's prime editing?
Yes, there is a new step in the CRISPR saga. a new chapter, as it were. And this one utilizes actually the Cas9 portion of the CRISPR-Cas9 system. So I won't do a too deep of a review of CRISPR-Cas9 and how it works, but suffice it to say, we've said it a lot on the show before, that CRISPR-Cas9 is it's an incredibly useful gene editing tool that has made kind of gene editing technology, or it is a gene editing technology that has made gene editing in the lab faster, cheaper, and more accessible to more researchers. And we've seen iterations with this technology, but there was a really kind of big breakthrough recently, and it has its own name. They are calling it prime editing. There's actually kind of three iterations. So the quick and dirty, when we look back at, you know, traditional CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing, which is, you know, probably at this point the most widely used gene editing tool used in labs, there are two portions to classic CRISPR. So there's a DNA slicing enzyme called Cas9, and so that knows where on the DNA it's going to cut. And then there's a strand of guide RNA that tells where to cut. So you've got Cas9, which cuts, and guide RNA that says, this is where you cut. You can add different enzymes to your system to, like, turn a gene on or off, unzip the DNA a little bit, do knockouts for individual letters. But then at that point, you're basically kind of relying on the body, the cells themselves, to utilize the repair machinery that already exists to install the new DNA correctly. So you've got the CRISPR-Cas9, it tells the DNA where to cut, and then it cuts it. You have to additionally provide a copy of the new DNA to correct whatever it is you're trying to correct. And you've got to kind of hope that the body does its thing naturally to install it correctly. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't. A lot of times it does, but sometimes there are mistakes that are made. And there are also kind of off-target effects that happen there. This new technology called prime editing is sort of an iteration beyond something that was the next step from CRISPR-Cas9. So we've got CRISPR-Cas9. And then beyond that, we had something called base editors. And they're like a little bit more surgical. The same lab that developed prime editing developed base editors. And there's actually a great quote from the researchers that say, if CRISPR-Cas9 is like scissors and base editors are like pencils, then you can think of prime editors, things we're talking about right now, to be like word processors. Okay, so that's a good analogy, but that doesn't really explain what happened. So hopefully I can do this justice. In their paper and in some of their infographics that they offer when teaching about this, they're calling this search and replace genome editing. So the way that prime editing works is you've got the Cas9 enzyme. That's, you know, the same with CRISPR-Cas9. But the Cas9 enzyme has actually been modified so that instead of cutting the DNA all the way across, it only nicks one strand of the DNA. So remember, DNA is like a ladder. It's just going to cut the one side. Connected to that Cas9 enzyme is a reverse transcriptase enzyme, which I know is a big complicated term, but it does exactly what it says it does, reverse transcriptase. So I don't know if you guys remember way back to biology class, transcription, speaks back to, you know, the central dogma of molecular biology. You guys remember that? So the central dogma of molecular biology is DNA to RNA to protein. And that's how transcription and translation work. So you start with the DNA that codes, then the RNA, then that translates to build those proteins. So reverse transcriptase goes the other direction, if that makes sense. So this is another enzyme that actually forces that. It can generate new DNA by copying an RNA template. It goes the other way. Okay, so you've got your Cas9, and you've got a reverse transcriptase connected to it. And then there's a third component connected called prime editing guide RNA, or PEG RNA. So this tells where the target is. So it finds exactly where on the DNA it should be cut. And then the Cas9 actually is going to cut that one side of the DNA, remember. So within that PEG RNA, there are two components. There's a part that binds to the DNA that's been cut. And then there's a section of RNA letters that actually encode the edit that you're looking for. So what you end up doing is you've got that edited sequence that's transferred from the PEG RNA to the target DNA, the DNA that already exists in the body. The reverse transcriptase is then going to read the RNA, and it's going to attach the corresponding DNA letters to that one side of the DNA. So now you have these new letters that are written into the DNA, but it's only on one side of the ladder. So then we need to remove the old stuff. The old stuff gets excised out using an endonuclease, which is just a different type of protein and a different type of enzyme, which is a protein. And then you basically have this DNA where one side of the strand has been edited and the other side hasn't. So it doesn't match up. Because remember from basic biology that DNA has to pair the same way. It's always A to T and C to G. You can't pair A and C or T and G. So because it's mismatched, it's going to have some pairs that are not able to bond. So it's got to resolve that mismatch. There's a different guide RNA that's actually then going to direct the editor to nick the unedited strand and remake that strand. So the first side of the DNA gets edited first, then the second side gets edited to match up. And in doing that, you have now a clean edit that can be down to the individual base pair, like the individual nucleotide level. And what the researchers are saying is that not only is this more precise, but it actually is prone to fewer errors because it's got so many steps and they're all combined into one, as opposed to like nicking the DNA with one enzyme and then going in and changing the targets with another enzyme and then having to do another step. Since this is all kind of a nice little compact system, you end up with fewer off-target errors. And I mean, here's the crazy part. I mean, in the Nature article that was just recently published, the researchers themselves say that this type of technology has the potential to basically correct, I don't want to say cure, but correct 89% of genetic diseases. But let's not get ahead of ourselves because it's never been done in a human. It has been done in human cells. In petri dishes. But what I did read, which is kind of interesting, is that this complex, because it has so many components, is so large. I mean, these are big proteins that A, they can't put it in a viral vector like they typically would be able to because it won't fit. And B, it might even be so large that it would clog a microneedle when they go to inject it. So that's, you know, obviously an issue that they have to get past. Generally speaking, when gene editing takes place, viral vectors are the way you do it.
There are some low-hanging fruit that you should pick. Like sickle cell, the interesting thing there is you could take out the bone marrow. You could then use gene editing to fix all the hemoglobin genes and then do it and then transplant the bone marrow back in. So you don't have to do it inside a person. We already know how to do this.
They've actually been able in the out of the body, like in human cells, but in culture, to correct the gene variants involved in Tay-Sachs disease, in cystic fibrosis, and also in sickle cell, which is a really big deal. Like those are three, I mean, maybe they're like low-hanging fruit because they're easier to edit, but come on, like this could be huge. But again, I do think that this is an example of when the technology moves so fast that sort of the clinical trials and the ethics can't quite follow.
Yeah, but I think that, you know, the technology is advancing extremely fast. I mean, it was just 7 years ago that CRISPR was discovered, basically. You know, already we've improved upon it. You know, multiple ways. We are still on the steep part of the curve of the basic technology. The problem is the translational research can't catch up, right? So translating any particular CRISPR-type technology into a treatment, by the time you even begin designing the trial, there's a better version of the CRISPR out there. So do we just switch over to that new one or continue with the old one?
But at the same time, like this is what we've been waiting for. And so hopefully we're just that much closer. Hopefully we're going to see that human trials can happen, you know, somewhat more quickly. And, you know, it does seem like there's, as far as they can see, no real negative side effects, knock on wood, that could change once we start doing human trials. But this is a really hopeful step for sure.
And for a lot of genetic diseases, even if you, if the genetic disease is you're not making a protein because the gene is busted, then you might only need to get to 5 or 10 or 20% of the cells in order to make enough of the protein to mostly compensate for the genetic disease. You know what I mean? So you don't have to get to every single last cell.
You know, we've seen ethical concerns around germline editing as opposed to just editing somatic cells, because in one, you're fixing something in a single individual. In another, you're changing the DNA that's then going to be passed on to offspring. So, I mean, that's a really, it's a much larger outcome with potentially more severe unintended consequences if they do exist.
Yeah, that's in the gene pool. But if all you're doing is fixing a genetic mutation that causes a horrible disease, I don't think that we're going to have a problem with that. The advantage of this approach over existing CRISPR is that this has fewer off-target mistakes. This is more precise. It's more accurate than the previous CRISPR technology. So,
which was already fairly accurate, right? I mean, it was already...
This is significantly... But it's also just that it's not just the size of this of the piece that's being swapped out. It's like, it's the targeting, right? Because the Cas9, you know, famously, like the CRISPR-Cas9 system has offsite targets that it has homology with. So you're going to make changes to the genome in locations that you don't want. But this has less, a lot less. And so this is a significant advance. And this might get us over that line where it's like, okay, now we're at a point where we could just like really go full on into translational research and start curing some diseases.
Steve, in your blog, you compare this to stem cell therapy and how there was hype, but now it's more of a mature technology and we have a more realistic appreciation of the potential. So you compare CRISPR, this new technique, and CRISPR itself to stem cell hype from 20 years ago. CRISPR seems different to me. It's similar in a lot of ways, but it also is advancing so fast, and it's just a fundamentally different type of technology. I think we have a reason to be more optimistic about the potential and the quick potential of this kind of technology.
I think there's reason for cautious optimism, absolutely, and it's not, I'm not saying it's the same exact risk versus benefit of potential as stem cells. I'm just saying it's the broad view that early right. on people look at the potential, right? And there's a lot of hype around the potential of the new technology. And then as we try to use it, we realize this is a lot harder than we thought. And there are some significant hurdles here.
Sure. Like high temperature superconductivity from 30 years ago. It's like, ugh.
And then 10, 20 years go by and people are like, where's all of the stem cell cures that we were promised in 2000? You know, this is literally where we were at. We're 20 years after the stem cell hype. And now researchers are starting to realize, yeah, there are some non-trivial problems with the app getting all the way to the end of an application with stem cell therapy. It's just really, really tricky.
Right.
We don't know if it's like these problems that Kara's bringing up may turn out to really stall translation into specific treatments, or we may be able to treat a few things and like pick the low hanging fruit and then quickly run out of things where the technology works. And then we run into stumbling blocks that may delay further applications for 20 or 50 years. We just don't know. We'll be able to look back and see what it's like. But yes, if it's always that if everything works out like we hope it will, the potential is amazing, because I think the potential here is so amazing because the DNA is a code. It is a computer code. And we know the code. You know, we know a lot about it. We're improving the technology of manipulating that code. And so the power that this is giving researchers is amazing. And just the research itself is it's cheap, it's fast, it's progressing very, very quickly.
But the complex interactions are, you know, complex. And
yes.
And another thing that distinguishes it, or at least compared to stem cells, is that stem cells had this, you know, this problem, you know, with, I mean, remember when Bush in 2001, he basically stopped a lot of research. Because of the
that was embryonic stem
cells, because of the implications of life and when life begins and all that stuff. This is different in that there is a similar connection in terms of, you know, should we do germline and all that stuff. But I think the research is happening a lot faster because doing it, you don't need to do it in people to advance the science, and we're seeing amazing results very fast because, you know, it's different in that way from stem cells.
That was not the ultimate limitation with stem cells, because they fixed that problem with technology. We figured out how to turn adult cells into stem cells that were potent enough that we could do most of what we wanted to do.
But we lost a good handful of years of research.
Yeah, probably lost a decade, is what I said.
Yeah, that's huge.
Estimate. So we will be talking about gene editing again in the future, because this is a rapidly changing, rapidly evolving technological, you know, advance that we're making here, and the implications are enormous. And I'm hoping that we're going to start knocking off some of the worst genetic diseases. Like, I think sickle cell is going to be one of the first to go. And that would be great because that's a horrible disease.
So when you get rid of it, though, does that mean it'll be programmed out of humanity, or it'll have to be – people will still get it and they'll be treated?
People will still get it. It'll be a lot lower. And then once it does happen, then, like, let's say you know you have a gene for Tay-Sachs, you could then do IVF and just have it make sure that you don't get it, you know, that you remove it from your genome before you fertilize the egg, you know. Yeah. All right, let's move on. So this is, Jay, you're going to talk about another technology, which we got a lot of questions about this week. And I do think this one probably is more hype than a genuine advance. But tell us about aluminum air batteries. What's aluminum air batteries?
It did seem extraordinarily rich with hype just by the way that the you know, like the first sentence here, ex-Navy officer turned inventor signs a multi-million-dollar deal to produce his electric car battery that will take drivers 1,500 miles without needing to charge. It doesn't really ring true, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And a quick heads up, this came from the Daily Mail, which is not what would be considered a completely, you know, respectable journal. The basic claim is that the inventor named Trevor Jackson developed a car battery and it has a 1,500-mile range. And of course, on the surface, yeah, that sounds great. But, you know, once we start to peel back the hype and look at the details, it's not really all that they're making it out to be. So 1,500-mile range is about five times what today's lithium-ion batteries can handle. And it would be the difference between charging your battery, say, you know, every day or while your car was parked at work, to maybe once or twice a week, which is pretty significant if you think about it. You know, a daily charge versus a weekly or maybe twice a week charge, that's pretty damn significant. The article also says the inventor came up with his original prototype 10 years ago, but the automobile industry wanted nothing to do with it. And you got to ask yourself the question here. There's an obvious flaw, and that is the electric car industry would completely embrace an advanced battery technology because it would give a significant boost to capturing the market. You know, why would they turn away another styled battery? Who cares what the thing is that's supplying the electricity, as long as it's efficient and safe and has all the signs of a good battery? It doesn't matter what the underlying technology is. The car companies want something that will work, that is, you know, that's going to do all the things that it needs to do. So the breakthrough that the inventor is talking about is an aluminum air battery. With a little bit of research, you can find that these batteries were invented originally in the 60s, and in some cases, even today, these types of batteries are being used. And the quote-unquote stored energy actually comes from oxidizing the aluminum that's present. So to be clear, this is not really the kind of battery that's charged and discharged. It's a kind of battery.
Yeah. So just to be clear. So in fact, some people say it's not even a battery. It's more like an energy cell, right?
Yeah.
A power cell, because the energy is coming from aluminum, which is being oxidized with oxygen from the air. Right, that's why it's an aluminum air battery.
But it needs the special sauce. It needs an electrolyte solution.
It needs electrolyte solution, which is the one, which is the advance that this guy made. That's it. So aluminum air batteries already exist, and he didn't really make them any better. He just innovated by his claim. He has a less toxic version of the electrolyte solution. Great, but when you discharge the aluminum air battery, you can't recharge it or reload it in any way. You have to remanufacture it. Right, you have to recycle the aluminum, and you have to put in, again, more energy than you got out of it in order to decouple it from the oxygen.
Yeah, but the complexity with this, with that model is, you know, one, these things are heavy, right? So batteries are heavy. Even if it has an aluminum architecture, it's going to be a really heavy battery. And if you do some quick math, if you downsized this 1,500-mile range battery down to what the batteries of today are, which are 300-mile range batteries, then let's say that the battery weighs somewhere around 240 pounds, which was an armchair calculation. It's still a phenomenally heavy thing that the average person could never maneuver by themselves. Like, what we need is infrastructure, just like with electric cars, right? How are we going to recharge our electric cars? We need charging stations, and they have to be freaking everywhere. Well, in order to have this battery technology be the winning technology to fuel batteries, there we would need, like, you know, battery swap out stations, whatever it is. Like, you know, you back your car in and a robot arm comes down and lifts it out and plops a new one in. you know, that those don't exist. I bet none. There's probably not even one that in existence on the planet today.
So you could have like 10 24 pound batteries instead of one 240 pound battery. Again, that's for a regular old 300 mile range, which what's the point of that, right? If you're going to go for the 1500 mile range, then you're talking like a 1200 pounds of battery that you would have to swap out. So that 1500 mile range is not going to come with any convenience. Even if you broke that up, so what are you going to have? Let's say you have 50 pound batteries, you're going to have 24 50 pound batteries that you got to swap out when you recharge your car.
And you'd be doing it every week. You got to think about that. It's not like a recharge. Like you're going somewhere and having to spend the time. And then like, you know, I don't know if you're seeing what I'm seeing, but man, talk about recycling.
And then those batteries have to be recycled. Yeah.
You know, recycling aluminum is effective. It works. You know, we recycle aluminum cans. You could reuse aluminum. From what my understanding, there isn't really like aluminum fatigue in this regard because you're consuming the aluminum. It doesn't add up. There's not enough pluses to the minuses that I'm seeing. Now, there's some optimism towards this technology in general, right? Because aluminum is everywhere. It's inexpensive. It's, you know, it's not a trouble to get and to produce and to recycle. There are things about it that are nice. It really just comes down to, you know, how advanced is the technology? How much could we roll it out? How quickly and inexpensively could we roll it out? And then what are the true ecological implications here? Like how deep would it go? You can't just talk about the battery today. Like, you know, 50 years ago, sure, just talk about the battery because you chuck it in the dump. Today, we got to talk about like the end game of every single piece of metal and object that you create. Where is it going to go?
So what I couldn't find, and this is the one piece of information we really need to evaluate the efficiency of this system, and that is what is the round trip energy efficiency, right? So if you take a spent battery, you recycle it, you know, you reinstall it into another car, for the energy that you're getting out of it, how much energy did you have to put in? What is the efficiency? And how does that compare to charging an electric battery, you know, lithium ion battery, or even, you know, putting a gallon of gas in your car? What is the comparative energy efficiency? I just suspect the energy efficiency of this whole process of remanufacturing these one-off batteries is not going to be great. And that may be a deal killer.
Steve, it's not a renewable. It's not coming from solar radiation or wind. You know, this is like stuff we're melting, or, you know, you're oxidizing.
Well, it depends on what the energy source is to make the batteries. But again, basically that would be what's the mix of energy for our grid. You know, I mean, that's unrelated to that issue. You know, if we got 100% of our energy from renewables, then this would be renewable, you know. So I think the infrastructure is a problem. Not that, you know, a lot of new technologies need new infrastructure, but is it worth it? We need to figure out what the round trip energy efficiency is and you know, again, the how are we going to actually work this? You know, what kind of infrastructure are we going to need for swapping out 1200 pounds of battery? But what if we did this? Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of like, is there a way that this technology could be useful? So Jay, what if we have a hybrid.
It's a hybrid.
Yeah. In other words, you have a car that has an electric engine and it has a battery and it can accept the aluminum air fuel cells.
Okay.
So if you, let's say you have a battery, instead of having, so here's the thing. Right now we have cars, the lithium ion batteries with, let's say, a 300 mile range. That's more than you need for your commute and it's not really long enough for a long trip. Right. It's not long enough that it alleviates range anxiety for long trips. And it's way more than most people need for their daily commute. So what if you do this? You have a lithium ion battery in your car that has a 60 mile range. And that 60 mile range is enough for most people's daily commute. And that's the battery. That's the energy that you're going to be using most of the time. Plus, if you have a rechargeable battery, you get the regenerative braking, right? With this battery, you don't get regenerative braking, which is a huge efficiency bonus. And then you have the aluminum air batteries when you exceed your 60 mile range. Then if you go on a long trip, you have a backup aluminum air battery that can get you your 1,000 miles, let's say. But you otherwise are not using it. You're using the rechargeable battery. I don't know if that system will work. You know what I mean? So maybe you're only having to swap out that battery a few times a year when you take long trips and for your day-to-day you're just using your rechargeable battery. That may be the, there might be a sweet spot in there. That's the best of all worlds. I don't know. That's the kind of thing I think experimentation in the marketplace is going to tell us if that kind of hybrid system is worthwhile. There's another problem that I discovered with these batteries. They auto discharge. Once the electrolyte solution is in contact with the aluminum, it oxidizes. Like, you can't stop it from oxidizing. So what you have to do is, when you're storing, once you manufacture the battery, when you're storing it, you have to keep the solution separate from the aluminum. And then once you initiate using that battery, then you introduce the electrolyte solution. But then once you do that, that battery's cooked, right? It won't store well after that point. It'll just auto discharge. But of course, if you have multiple smaller batteries, that would be a partial solution to that, because you're only going to use up the current battery that you're using. The other ones will still be protected until they're needed. But if you have the hybrid and you have a rechargeable battery, you could recharge your rechargeable battery off of the auto discharging aluminum air battery, theoretically. So that could also partially solve that problem as well. So there's a lot of complexity here to how this would integrate into a system. And there may be a role in somewhere, this kind of battery is probably better for things like satellites or probes, where you don't ever need to recharge it. You just need a long distance, energy dense, light battery that, once it's exhausted, it's done. Or, situations where the range is extremely, extremely important. But I think, my prediction is, before this kind of technology becomes commercializable, that rechargeable batteries will be good enough that it's pointless. The advantage will go away.
Yeah, probably.
We may end up with aluminum ion batteries, right? Because aluminum is more energy dense than lithium. It's also it's cheaper and more common. It's the third most common element in the Earth's crust. If they can get an aluminum ion battery to work and to be commercial, to get all the things that we need them to be, there's always some deal killer in there, right? Like, oh yeah, it's great in every way, but it only has a dozen recharge cycles. Wah, wah. I'm not sure, like, with the aluminum ion battery, what the holdup is. But anyway, I do think that of all the battery technologies out there, I wouldn't bet on this one, right? This is not the one that I'm betting on. But aluminum may be playing some role, just because of it. It has a lot, as an element, it has a lot of features that are good. But just the non-rechargeable thing, I think, is a deal killer, to be honest with you. At best, this will have maybe find a niche somewhere, but it's not going to be in your day-to-day car. All right, Bob, tell us about The Blob.
Oh, that movie from the 50s?
No, another blob. This is an organism, which is being called The Blob, is being presented now for the first time at a Paris zoo. It's so counterintuitive to common, well-known categories of life on Earth, that its characteristics will likely sound, maybe almost unbelievable to you, perhaps even monstrous, unless, of course, you are well acquainted with slime molds. Now, I love this blob. It's much nicer than the blob from the Steve McQueen movie from the 50s, or the very decent 1988 remake, which I recommend. It sounds like a riddle worthy of Gollum himself. What has no mouth or stomach yet eats. It moves without limbs. It learns and teaches others but has no brain. It has 720 sexes. So scientists have been calling it the blob, which is really cool. Scientifically, it's known as Physarum polycephalum, which means, as you might have can figure out by that last word, many-headed slime. It's a specific type of slime mold, though. It's called a plasmodial slime mold. It's essentially a single gigantic cell, very similar to an amoeba, actually, even to the extent of moving by extending those arm-like limbs that called pseudopods. If you looked really closely at it, it contains thousands of nuclei from previous cells before they joined. It's so big that it's actually particularly useful for helping us understand how slime molds work, because it's so large, it's easy to observe and it's easy to experiment with just based on its sheer size. It's big, but not as big as the blob in the movie.
Wait, is this like, you keep mentioning like it, is it like only one thing ever, or is this just one organism, but it exists more in the wild?
I'm talking, when I say it, I'm talking about the specific blob slime mold that is being unveiled at that Paris Zoo. So it's one example of this specific type of simul that's being like a lion in a cage type of. This is what they're doing for the first time. No other zoo has actually showcased this type of slime mold. It's not found in broken meteorites, and it doesn't consume flesh, fortunately, but it feeds on bacteria or fungi found on forest undergrowth. So it looks plant-like, but one of the very few definitive things we could say about this is that it's not a plant, plant. It shares traits, though, with animals and fungi, but it's neither and kind of both. And its family is Myxomycetes, but we're not really sure how to exactly classify it. It seems if scientists have to take the best guess, I think they would say that it's kind of somewhere in between an animal and fungi. Let's see, some of its other characteristics are interesting. It moves 4 centimeters per hour at most. So to put that into perspective, that's 680 trillionths of a light year per hour. So hopefully that helped.
Good units.
Yeah, thank you. It's also kind of like Wolverine in that it has amazing healing abilities. If you cut it in half, it will heal itself fully within 2 minutes. Hello? 2 minutes completely from being cut in half. Really cool. This is really fascinating. It could actually learn. They put it in a maze with food at one end, and it will figure out how to find the food. But not only that, if you let it do it again and again, it will get faster and faster and more efficient. If you put obstacles in its way, like salt, it will find a way around it, and then eventually find a way around it faster and more efficient every time it does it. If you fuse it with another blob, the other blob will then know how to cross the maze or how to deal with a previously conquered barrier. It will so essentially it's learning. It could actually teach what it learned from experience. So how does learning take place when you don't have the usual biological components needed to make memories as we understand them? Not sure. There's a lot that's mysterious about this type of slime mold, but it's fascinating. I love it. I wish Paris wasn't so far away, but maybe I'll just go into the woods and look in some dark undergrowth, some wet undergrowth in the forest, and maybe I'll find one. But it's really fascinating. I just saw so many news items about this blob. Like, what are they talking about? What blob? And now I know, and now hopefully you know too.
So explain the sexes?
Yeah, so with this specific slime mold, sex is determined by a lot of different types of genes, and they come in multiple variants at the same time. They reproduce by emitting or releasing these spores that develop into sex cells for successful reproduction to take place. All that needs to happen is for two sex cells containing different variants of those sex genes to meet.
The blob. Yeah,
yes,
cool.
That's why I picked it.
So have any of you guys heard of holotropic breathwork?
That sounds like some woo-woo bullshit.
No,
it's
a new band.
Holotropic breathwork? Yeah,
right. Is that deep breathing while consuming mushrooms on a holodeck?
No, but close.
Oh, wow, that's exactly it.
Bob. It's very close. No, it's hyperventilating while meditating.
No holodeck required.
Yeah, holotropic, what does that mean?
Tropic plants.
Moving towards wholeness. Here's a description. Here's a description by holotropic.com. Jeez. HB is a psychotherapeutic procedure involving hyperventilation, a voluntary, prolonged, mindful, and deep overbreathing procedure supported by music and elective bodywork. The HB session is largely nonverbal and without interventions. It concludes with mandala drawings and sharing. A typical HB session lasts for about 1 to 3 hours, and the client terminates the session voluntarily. So that's basically what it is. So yeah, so it's wooey as hell, as you said. And what does it do? How does it work? Well, I have a quote for that too. The process itself uses very simple means. It combines accelerated breathing with evocative music in a special set and setting. With the eyes closed and lying on a mat, each person uses their own breath and the music in the room to enter a non-ordinary state of consciousness. This state activates the natural inner healing process of the individual psyche, bringing the seeker a particular set of internal experiences. With the inner healing intelligence guiding the process, the quality and content brought forth is unique to each person and for that particular time and place. While recurring themes are common, no two sessions are ever alike. So
inner
what does that
healing
sound
intelligence?
Like? Yeah, this is a vision quest, right? This is a shamanistic, spiritual journey facilitated by physiologically altering your state of consciousness, right? This has a long tradition in many cultures where hallucinogens were used. Every culture, it seems, was very adept at locating the plants in their local environment that were hallucinogenic, right? And what I like about this kind of story is that people interpret brain experiences as external experiences, right? So their brain function is altered and they have a trip, you know, a psychedelic trip, and they say, this is me connecting with the universe, not my brain is glitching, you know, my brain is malfunctioning. So one is use of hallucinogens, psychedelics, psychoactive medications as a supernatural spiritual experience, part of which becomes part of religion. Then starting pretty much in the 1960s, using, you know, psychologists like, hey, let's use hallucinogens as psychotherapy, right? To see if we can, you know, get a psychological intervention out of this. Interestingly, I was able to find only a few published studies dealing with holotropic breathwork. One of them was it's a spiritual experience that makes you a better person. The other one was, hey, I wonder if we could use this as psychological therapy, right? So it's the same exact sort of process. There was one interesting article that was like, okay, this is, I think, how this could be exploited for psychological treatment. If we have people do this, you're basically mimicking symptoms of a panic attack. And then we can use it like as exposure therapy to the panic attack and then teach people cognitive behavioral therapy to deal with it so they don't catastrophize the symptoms. So you have the symptoms, like exposure therapy. You have the symptoms in a controlled environment while you have somebody there helping you not catastrophize. And then when you have your panic attack, you'll be prepared for it and able to do the cognitive therapy that you need. So that's interesting, but that has absolutely nothing to do, you know, with how this stuff is being promoted and how it's being used.
Yeah, you could send them to that haunted house we talked about.
Yeah, right.
So in any case, this is being promoted by a guy, a guru, right, who invented it in 1979. Stanislav Grof, 1975, actually. Stanislav Grof. It's surging in popularity, which is why I'm getting a lot of questions about it, which is why I wanted to talk about it. But of course, you give it a fancy name, holotropic breathwork. But you're right. Yeah, it's hyperventilating with music and meditation. And what does it do for you? You know, if you hyperventilate, you drive down your CO2. You drive down the CO2, it causes alkalosis of your blood. It makes your blood more alkaline, basic. Because CO2 is an acid, right? If your CO2 rises, your blood becomes acidic. If you blow it off, your blood becomes alkaline. You voluntarily or involuntarily hyperventilate, you get your CO2 levels go artificially low. You get alkaline blood, and then that causes tingling. It can cause shortness of breath, which can paradoxically lead you to hyperventilate more. That's why you have to breathe into a bag to kind of break that cycle. You can get lightheaded, and yeah, you get like dizzy and, you know, it's like it's like holding your breath. It can absolutely alter your state of consciousness all the way to passing out, you know, which then usually takes care of the problem by itself once you pass out. Yeah, it's just a way of inducing your brain to glitch so that you feel weird. And then that weirdness becomes your spirit journey, you know, is the bottom line. But the idea that you're accessing some kind of inner world or inner intelligence is obviously just made up.
So we're calling panic attacks now an inner journey.
Yeah, right. That's basically what they're saying.
Yeah, no, that's anybody that's had a legit panic attack, if they are confusing that with an inner journey, they need to have a lot more fun in their life, because there's nothing, you know, I mean, I can't say that you're not going to learn. You can learn from those types of experiences in one kind of way of looking at it.
Yeah.
But it really is like the most awful feeling that you could have.
Right. But apparently you don't always get a panic attack when you do this. You just get lightheaded and dizzy. And all right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
Okay, last week I played this noisy. I have a favorite part in that noisy. You guys have a favorite part?
Sounded like V'ger initially.
There, if you listen carefully, there's a little girl sighing or something in the middle of that. That is so Adam Hepburn and his daughter Olivia created this noisy for us, and that's his little daughter Olivia. was freaking so cute. Oh, man. All right. So anyway, I had lots of guesses. Dane Milner wrote in and said, long-time listener, first-time guesser. This week's noisy sounds like a metal slinky being pulled apart then plucked on one end to create the wave. Very cool. You know, I've done this. And it does that, you know, it sounds like that a little bit. That's not correct, but it definitely, you know, it's got a metallic vibe to it, which I completely see why you thought that. Brian Gleason wrote in, and Brian says, Jay, I think this week's noisy might be what is sometimes called a thunder generator. Essentially, a hollow tube with a membrane on one end, and attached to the middle of the membrane is some sort of wire or cord, similar to a wound guitar string or long, tight, flexible spring. Very similar to, you know, this is me talking, very similar to the previous guest. Holding the tube with one hand, you can then either wiggle it side by side, which generates the thunder sound, or what does this sound like, or what it sounds like in this clip. He did send a clip. So bottom line is, it's kind of like a slinky inside of a tube that has a bladder attached to it, or a membrane that it really does enhance the sound. It gives it a much more echoey thing. It's very, very cool.
Jay.
Yeah.
Is it insane in the membrane?
Insane in the brain. So Ben wrote in, said, hi guys, Ben here from Japan. Thanks for the great show every week. This week's sound is without a doubt the waterphone of sort, a musical instrument consisting of cylindrical resonators filled with water and pipes of different lengths, soldered all around. When you rub the pipes, very weird inharmonic sounds are created. It was invented in the late 60s by Richard Waters, who's an artist. Maybe this is a variation of the one the listener made. This is not
inharmonic.
Correct. Yes. Doesn't and he signs off with live long and prosper. Ben, you clearly have been paying attention. One SGU point. No, that's incorrect, but now I have to see this thing. I'm going to look for one. I think I may have come across this at one point, but I will double check. So the winner for last week is his name is Jakob Lutzen, and he said that sound was definitely made by a piano. By holding the pedal down and quickly stroking the strings. That sound should be familiar to everyone that grew up as a kid with a piano in the house. Playing with the strings inside the piano was one of my favorite games when I was 9 and bored at home. Love the show. I'm a proud Nanomorph, which means he's a proud patron of the show, and he's heard every episode. Come to Copenhagen. I've been to Copenhagen on multiple occasions. However, I do not travel to Copenhagen anymore. So we
is that anywhere near Copenhagen?
Don't. Oh man, really? Jeez, I can't even. I cannot learn how to pronounce every city and you know, I can't do it. That's it. I give up. I internet tap out. Okay, I can't pronounce everything. I can't even pronounce my English words, guys. If you haven't noticed, so. Adam, thank you, and thanks, Olivia, so much for sending in this cool noisy. Now, I picked the noisy, one, because there was a Halloween twist on it that I wanted to do for Bob, but also because I had the same experience that Jakob said, that, you know, when you were a kid, you had a piano. Yeah, we had a piano, you know, and I messed around with the wires in there. So thank you very much for your guesses, and every once in a while, guys, I send you what I would consider to be an easy one because I want to see if you're paying attention, and I did get a ton of responses, so apparently you are listening. Next, the new noisy of the week. This was sent in by a listener named Julia Bell. What a great noisy.
Yeah.
If you think you know what the noisy is this week, or if you heard something crazy like that sound I just played, email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
So, guys, you know what today is?
Yes. I know.
Yes. A little bit before Halloween.
Yes. It's 1 month exactly before we leave on our trip down under.
Whoa.
Oh, wow.
Going back to Australia
and
New Zealand. Yeah, really looking forward to it. So, why are we going to Australia and New Zealand?
Yeah.
You might be asking yourself. Well, because we're going to Christchurch at a conference, conference in Christchurch, and that is the New Zealand Skeptical Conference. Then we're going over to Melbourne to do the Australia Skeptical Conference. Skepticon, yep. So take a look at our site. You'll see the dates on those. We're going to be giving tons of lectures, doing tons of events, and we're also going on the way there. We're going to be stopping in Los Angeles. Kara's backyard, right?
Yeah.
Kara's going to give us a tour of her living room. And then
after that, I'll have a tour of the bathroom. Thank you very much.
We're going to be doing our first Skeptical Extravaganza 2.0.
Right. That's on November 23rd at the Dynasty Typewriter. But you don't need to remember any of this. All you need to do is go to theskepticsguide.org and go to our events page, and you'll see a list of everything we have coming up. Now, I'm sorry, all the private shows are completely sold out. Every once in a while, somebody returns a ticket because they can't make it after all, and they get snatched up. I keep close eye on these things, and I'm like, you know, they go within 15 minutes. But you can come and see us in LA at the Dynasty Typewriter for the extravaganza. It's 2.0. We have it's a reworked version of the show, and we're incredibly excited to do it because we've just been working on it a lot over the last 3 or 4 months.
And yeah, then at the end of January, beginning of February, we'll be doing an extravaganza in Pittsburgh, in Philadelphia, and in Brooklyn.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Kara will be flying to the East Coast and joining us, and all the rogues will be there with George Robb, of course. It's going to be a lot of fun. Again, we're going to make the show better every time we do it.
All of those shows are on our website, so you could definitely go there. Now, I also want to remind everyone that we have the Star Trek Phaser Rifle contest that we've been running. When we get close to or on 4,000 patrons for the SGU, we will be doing another torture thing like this haunted house. No, we'll be doing a 12-hour we'll be doing a 12-hour live stream. Become a patron of either one of our shows. We need your support. We want your support, and it's valuable because you get stuff. You get great content. You get to be in a living room with us, so you could be in the bathroom or driving to work, wherever you want. I don't care. As a matter of fact, I don't want to know where you're listening to us. That's your private time, not mine. So please do go to theskepticsguide.org/T3, and please do go to theskepticsguide.org/events and check out everything that we have coming at you.
Jay, we just got 100 emails. People are wondering what this tri-emitter actually is, so I got to answer that. It's three emitters. It's got the particle beam emitter, it's got the gravitational wave emitter, and a gamma ray laser emitter. And it is messy when you get hit with all three of those in your mind.
And if you want to see it in action, you could watch the Alpha Quadrant 6 video that we shot, where we go into the whole detail about how the phaser rifle was conceived, how it was created, how it was delivered, how it was constructed, and then Steve kills somebody famous with it. All right, and our set, so it really came out. It was funny. I don't know. I edited it. I'm very pleased with what I did, I have to admit. But it is funny. I was going for comedy there, and it's ridiculous. So please go watch that video.
All right, thanks, you guys. Evan, you have a dumbest thing of the week.
I do, in fact. Ken Ham.
Oh, boy.
Stop right there. You've said enough.
That's it.
Wait, for a second, I thought you said canned ham.
You wish I Legit. Said canned ham. No, I said Ken, as in Kenneth Ham, a creationist. He believes the Earth is only 6,000 years old. He runs a Noah's Ark-themed attraction in Kentucky. And yes, there are T-Rexes on the Ark, in case you were wondering.
Of course there were.
You know, dinosaurs and all that. So, Ken Ham has some Halloween advice for everyone. Instead of giving traditional treats to the kiddies during the trick-or-treat festivities on October 31st, So Ham is suggesting giving away some, well, items that he sells, including fake $1 million bills, which is kind of repetitive in a way. There are no real $1 million bills, but his $1 million bills had pictures of things like a T-Rex or Noah's Ark on the front and warnings of eternal damnation on the back. Here's a sample of what's on the back of one of his $1 million bills. Have you ever lied, stolen, or used God's name in vain? If so, you've broken God's law. The penalty for your crimes against God is death and eternal hell, because God is holy and just.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that nice? The real spirit of Halloween comes out. Here's another bill, which again, Ham wants you to give to little kids on Halloween. He warns against lust, which he says is the same as committing adultery. God's,
oh boy.
Yep,
I God's am doomed.
Yeah. God sees you as guilty of sin. The penalty of sin is death and eternity in hell.
Mm-hmm.
Ken
Ham, it's really not fair to hold people accountable for what they think. I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, you think? Of course. Now here's something I thought of. So he's saying, warn you against lust, which is the same as committing adultery.
Mm-hmm.
So, therefore, if you keep your lust to yourself, I guess in that way masturbation's okay, but I think there might be a conflict.
Guess about what?
Well, right, because then you're being true to yourself. Then you're not committing adultery if you just keep it to yourself. But if you have lustful thoughts of other people, that is committing adultery in the mind. Of
But masturbation and having lustful thoughts of other people are not mutually exclusive.
Yes, but
there's an entire industry based upon the relationship between those two things.
So he also urges people to buy and distribute other items he sells, like booklets about the evils of modern day Halloween. Right, Bob?
Oh, yeah.
And of course, he suggests that you should do reverse trick-or-treating, in which you should be the one to give out gospel booklets when you visit door to door. So become your own little minion of Ken Ham's army by spreading his word. There you have it. Ken Ham, he's ruined Halloween for everyone. He is, in fact, our dumbest thing of the week.
All right. Thanks, Evan.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. All right, you guys ready for three regular news items this week?
Yes, sir.
Regular.
That's
regular.
Too bad, because I don't have three regular news items.
You have four.
What? I have three slightly irregular news items. All right, guys, here we go. Item number one. Scientists have developed a new method of mining and processing rare earth elements with minimal environmental impact compared to current methods. Item number two. For the first time, scientists prove that human fetuses have a complex gut microbiome prior to birth. And item number three, a new paper outlines a method for detecting wormholes. All right, Jay, go first.
All right, his first one here, scientists have developed a new method for mining and processing rare earth elements with minimal environmental impact compared to current methods. So I have a new method of the thing that I don't like about this thing is the processing of rare earth elements, like all rare earth elements. You're not saying which one specifically or if it's just one, which is a generalization, which we don't like. We don't like here in science or fiction. The next one, for the first time, scientists proved that human fetuses have a complex gut microbiome prior to birth. Wow, that's interesting. How does the biome get in there? How would they have a complex gut microbiome? I thought that type of stuff doesn't pass the placenta barrier. The final one, a new paper outlines a method for detecting wormholes. Now, I'm assuming here you're talking about like outer space wormholes.
Yeah,
not wormholes in apples.
Yeah,
or in the soil.
You know, the one about the wormholes, like it could all be theoretical. Like if they exist, this would be the way we theoretically would detect them. So I'm not going to be too stringent on that one. The one about the human fetuses and the microbiome, that one's troubling just because it contradicts information I have. But of course, you know, science is always updating and overturning information that we have. And my big question is how does that bacteria get in there? Because you got to think, you know, that's a very much a you're born and then the bacteria is passed to you from your family. The new method for processing a rare earth, I don't like that one either because of what I said, that, you know, it's kind of a generalization. I'm going to say that one's the fake, the rare earth one, and there you have it, Steve.
Okay, Bob.
All right, detecting the wormhole, yeah, theoretical. There could be some weird method they came up with that could potentially detect them, I guess. Can't really think of one right now. The microbiome, yeah, I'm not buying that one either. Jay had very good reasons for that, so I won't really add much to it. Yeah, I think I will go with the rare earth elements as well. Not because it's ambiguous about what rare earth elements, but the fact that, I mean, to really do this mining, you'd have to go deep, and I could see them superficially, you know, near the surface grabbing some of these minerals, but to go really deep, you really got to get invasive unless you really have a creative solution, some advanced technology to go deep. So I'll say that's fiction as well.
Okay, Evan?
I don't like it when people go before me and then what they say makes me rethink everything I just thought of myself. But I will agree that I think the detection of wormholes is going to be science. There's no problem with a new paper outlining a method. It's fine. I thought the gut microbe prior to birth one was probably going to be the fiction, only because I was more convinced that the new method of mining and processing rare earth elements having a minimal impact on the environment was going to be the fiction, because what they're doing to get these rare earth elements is so massive and intrusive, in a sense, because you're digging up swaths and swaths of earth, you're going deep, and you're just pulling out, you know, very trace pieces of these elements, that it could only get more environmentally favorable. It's hard to do it the other way. It seems like a natural evolution of the process. So that was my thought there. So based on that, that leaves me with the complex gut microbiome as being the fiction. So I guess that's what I'll say.
Okay. And Kara.
Yeah. I mean, obviously for me too, I think it's between those two, because there's nothing, every so often, Steve, you just make something up. And you could have very easily been like, yeah, new paper outlines a method for detecting wormholes, and you got us. If that's the case, you just got us if you made that up. But anybody, you know, can write a theoretical paper about anything. Hopefully it's a good paper. I don't know. But I'm going to think that that one's science. So I think for me, yeah, it's between those two. But then the other one has so many steps. It's not just a new method of mining, but also processing them that reduces their environmental impact. Unless like mining and processing are kind of as a whole, and it, like, throw them together, and it's still less than the, you know what? I'm going to go with Evan on this. I'm changing my mind. I'm going to say they did it. They found it in mice and not people.
All right. Well, let's start with number three, since you guys all agree on that one. A new paper outlines a method for detecting wormholes. Is this just typical speculative, you know, astrophysics, or did I make this one up out of whole cloth?
I almost hope this is the fiction.
I know, me too.
Do you?
Well, sort of, this that way one, we all lose.
I hope it's real.
This one is science.
Okay.
So yeah, this was the easy one this week. So because it's theoretical, but they didn't have to just come up with an idea. They had to actually figure out, is there a way to detect a wormhole? The paper actually says how to spot a wormhole, and then in parentheses, if they exist.
That's what Jay said.
Yeah. How do you think they do it? What's the method being proposed here?
Gravity.
That's right. Gravity.
But what,
gravity of what?
The wormhole.
No. It's pretty interesting, actually. Bob, you have any ideas? Did you read this?
Oh, Bob.
I did not read it.
Of course. It's space worms making
something,
the wormholes.
But maybe, how about something to do with entanglement?
Hear you. No. No, the idea is this, that stars on one side of the wormhole would be affected by the gravitational pull of stars on the other side of the wormhole. That the gravitational influence would actually pass through the wormhole. So if we are looking at stars and we see a gravitational effect on their movement that can't be explained by observable things, it might be because they're near a wormhole. And then they're being affected by the gravity for things on the other side. But you'd need to look in a location where wormholes are predicted if they can exist. And that would be
black holes.
Black holes near a very, very strong gravitational field, such as Sagittarius A, which Bob mentioned, I believe, last week. The supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way.
Sagittarius A star, it's called.
Yeah, Sagittarius A star, thank you. The paper I'm reading just says Sagittarius A, but that's right. Yeah, so if you look at stars orbiting Sagittarius A, and if they have anomalous movement, it might be because they're in the vicinity of a wormhole.
I heard what you did
there. But couldn't the black hole have a gravitational impact?
Of course, but they would have to say it's a gravitational anomaly not accounted for by what they know is there, like the black hole.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah,
strange.
So it's at least testable, right? I mean, you could, but of course, it's dependent on this method working and black and wormholes actually existing.
And it also depends on highly accurate recordings of the gravity from the black hole, because I would think it would be a minor, you know, change to, you know, to what's there from the black hole.
You are absolutely correct.
Damn accurate.
That's a good point, Bob. You're absolutely correct. And they actually say that we don't have the precise measurements now capable of testing this, but maybe in 10 or 20 years, we'll have precise enough instruments to look for the subtle effects that the wormholes would cause.
Okay.
All right, let's go back to number one. Scientists have developed a new method of mining and processing rare earth elements with minimal environmental impact compared to current methods. Bob and Jay think this one is the fiction. Kara and Evan think this one is science. Ugh. It's the battle of the Novella brothers versus Kara and Evan. Who's going to win this week? Two people have to win. Two people have to lose. Yes.
The question is, who do you love more? You know?
Yeah.
Is that what this is?
No, it's always about the science, Jay. And this one...
Science doesn't wipe your ass when you're 80 years old. I'm
is,
just saying.
It is if you build a robot. And this one is the fiction.
Damn.
Sorry, guys.
Sorry, Kara. I led you astray. I followed my gut. I followed my gut.
Yeah, so the mining and processing of rare earths is a horribly... It's the processing is the big part because it's very toxic, you know, what you have to do. The problem is it's hard to separate the rare earths because they have such similar properties. So how do you separate elements out, right? You have to exploit some difference in their properties. Ideally, they're chemically different, so you could just wash them with an acid, and one of the element you're looking for will be dissolve or not dissolve or bind or not bind, and everything else will or won't, right? So just if it's reacting differently, or if you have different melting points, right? You could raise the temperature up to the melting point of one element that will then liquefy, and you could remove it, filter it out, and the other ones won't melt. Or you can use the specific gravity. This is actually when you're separating out the different isotopes of uranium, there really isn't any chemical or physical difference. You have to use their weight, so that's why you have to use the centrifuges, because they will separate out slightly over time in a centrifuge. So that's a problem with the rare earths. They're hard to separate out. Because they're so similar. So what the new study actually is a new method of separating out the rare earths using magnets, because they have slightly different magnetic properties, and that can help, you know, make it easier to separate them out. It doesn't just completely separate them out, but it makes the process a little bit easier. But this is not for mining or processing rare earths. This is for recycling rare earths. That's the difference. This is like, oh, because, you know, that's a problem now. Like, if you have a bunch of rare earths in your smartphone, and then when you're recycling your smartphone, it's not worth it to try to even get the rare earths out of it because it's too hard to separate them. If you had a method that could economically recover the rare earths from e-waste, that would be a huge benefit, correct? Right? That you could be able to recycle, and you won't have to process more new rare earth from ore. So if again, remains to be seen if this method's going to be commercially viable, but they were able to show proof of concept that, yeah, you could get some separation of recyclable rare earths using exploiting their magnetic properties, which is a neat idea. Okay, all of this means that for the first time, scientists prove that human fetuses of a complex gut microbiome prior to birth is science. This is an interesting study. So we, you know, obviously we know that, you know, kids are born with a microbiome. We could test that. But do they get it from their mothers as they're passing through the vagina? Or do they get it even if they're born cesarean, but are they getting it after birth, essentially? To what extent do they have a viable microbiome in their gastrointestinal system while they're in the womb? How would we know? So you can collect meconium, which is basically fetal poop, and see what's in there. But then, is the bacteria getting in there from the gut, or was it getting in there from the amniotic fluid? So they needed to be able to demonstrate that there is living, viable bacteria in the gut of fetuses. They can look at the DNA floating around in the amniotic fluid and see that, yeah, there's bacteria there. They could tell from their DNA traces, but they needed to close the loop and tell that there was actually living bacteria in the gut. So they did a study where they did cesarean sections. They did it on mice and they did it on people. And they did it under sterile conditions. And they had to be very, very careful. And they were able to demonstrate that the kids were born with a microbiome and that didn't come from any other source, right? Then the composition and predicted source of the fetal gut microbiota shifted between mid and late gestation. So they said, our results demonstrate a dynamic, viable mammalian fetal microbiota during in utero development. So they have mom's bacteria. Pretty cool. All right. So good job, Bob and Jay. All right. Evan, give us a quote.
Science is the great antidote to the poison of enthusiasm and superstition. Oh, boy. Written by Adam Smith. In his treatise, An Inquiry into the Nature and Causes of the Wealth of Nations.
Yeah, Adam Smith.
Which I think 1776 is when that was published. So you're going back quite a ways when you're talking Adam Smith. And I love when these little skeptical nuggets come up in the very old volumes and books that we...
But it's kind of interesting choice, though. So science is the great antidote to the poison of superstition. I'll buy that. But enthusiasm... what context was he saying that? Overly enthusiastic, yeah.
Correct. Right. That is correct.
Otherwise, it makes science look like a buzzkill.
No. No, I don't believe that that was the case at all.
Probably not. Probably not. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure,
thanks,
man.
Steve.
Yes.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.